Hare Krishna. I am very happy and very grateful and very honored and very everything else auspicious to be with all of you today. This very beautiful holy place in the great city of Chicago, Kishore Kishori Temple. And thank you so very much for being with us. To Nityananda Pran Prabhu for so kindly and graciously inviting me. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells us in second chapter, Matra sparshastukunteya sitosna sukatukata agamapayano nityastam stitikshashvabharata. That the non-permanent appearance and disappearance of happiness and distress, they come like the appearance of the winter and summer seasons. And one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. In this verse, the nature of the world and the nature of real happiness is being revealed. This verse in many ways is opening the doors to the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita to discover how we can go through the dualities of life without being disturbed. You see, the nature of the entire creation is it is built on the foundation of dualities. Happiness, distress. Honor, dishonor. Pleasure, pain. Success, victory. Dark, light. Health, disease. Birth, death. And we cannot escape these dualities as long as we're embodied within this world. And the nature of dualities is to be understood through its potential. Diversity brings about the deepest opportunity for pleasure, for happiness, and for love. Diversity creates beauty. It's like, I do not know who made this flower garland. Who made this flower garland? It's nice, so you could raise your hand. If but we... Which? Oh, you. It's very nice. Good things come from good people. Where's the beginning and the end? But you see, she, with her creative devotion, she balanced all of these various colors. Each flower has its own shape, its own texture, color, fragrance. And when they are artistically harmonized, it creates a beauty that we cannot have if everything was just the same. It's like food. Would you enjoy eating? Maybe you would, if everything tasted exactly the same. Yes? Now, some of you are from India, you like chili peppers. Would you be happy if all there was the taste of chili peppers? Maybe for some time, but not for long. So there's salt, and there's sweet, and there's sour, and there's pungent, and all different textures, all different flavors, all different aromas. And when they're harmonized properly, that brings happiness. But when they're not harmonized properly, it creates agitation. So similarly, in the world today, there are different species of life. There's humans. And there's elephants and cows and dogs and cats, and there's insects, and there's lizards, and there's birds, and there's even fish. So much variegatedness. And within the human species, there's different colors, different races, different religions, different propensities, different social statuses. And all of these diversities, when we unite, when we unite them like the thread of this garland, then it creates beauty. It creates wonderful, wonderful experience within the world. But when we do not understand that inherent unity, then there's egoism, there's envy, there's fear, there's hatred, there's war, there's terrorism, there's marital disasters, there's disasters between brothers and sisters. What is that? Seems like I'm supposed to harmonize with that. See, that could really agitate us, but if we just see it as some background music, it's very nice. But still, we should harmonize the switch that turns it off. Living in a house, a husband, a wife, brothers, sisters, even in a temple, in an ashram, different brahmacharis or whatever, we all have different natures. And the ego wants everyone to be like me. The way I think is the way they should think. But the problem is, they think that the way they think is the way I should think. So there's a conflict. But harmonizing means to honor and respect the differences we have with the higher principle. And that higher principle, Daivi Heshu Gunamai Mama Maya Duratiya, Mame Vamya Prabhadyante Maya Meta Durantite. Krishna tells in the Gita that this material nature, consisting of these three modes of nature, which are activating these dualities unlimitedly, is very difficult to overcome. But when we take shelter of the Lord, we can easily cross beyond it. That means taking shelter of that higher principle. Ralph Waldo Emerson, a great American author, he wrote that in the world, diversity is creating so much division on every level of humanity. And in so many cases, it's creating situations that leave us in ruins. He said the reason for this is that we have become disconnected from our own self. That's where it begins. The concept of yoga is to reunite. On a broader level, yoga means to reunite all humanity as brothers and sisters. Mamaivam so jivaloke jivabhutasanat. In bhakti, we understand that every living being is part of God. Every living being is Krishna in a little infinitesimal part. Just like the sun and the sun rays. Every sun ray is the sun, but it's just a little part of the sun. But the planet is the origin of all parts. And in the same way, every living being is a part of Krishna. But Krishna is the original source. And when we learn to love the original source, then we see Krishna in every part. Even if that part may be covered by all sorts of egoisms, still we see within there is a part of Krishna. To see that unity, to see that spiritual essence, we can't find that in others unless we realize how we're part of Krishna. And bhakti, or devotion, is the path of realizing that through love. Our relationship with Krishna is jivera swarupoy krishnera nityadas. That we're eternally servants of the Lord. But what does servant mean? In bhakti context, service is the highest possible realization. Prema pumarta mahan. Because nitya siddha krishna prema sajja kabunai saravanadi suduchiti koriye yudoi. Because praying, divine love, unconditional love for Krishna, is dormant within the heart of everyone. It's who we are. It's who we've always been. We've simply forgotten. When that love, that prem is awakened, then it is expressed through trying to please Krishna. In this world, when we love someone, we want to please them. We want to give them happiness. Even if it means some difficulty for ourselves. A good mother, she's willing to endure so many sacrifices to give happiness to her child. That's love. And on the highest, deepest, eternal, spiritual level, that's the nature of the soul's relationship with God. And when we understand, when we realize the glory of seva, unconditional service, as an expression of our love, and also as the means by which we awaken that love, then we naturally extend that same realization toward every living being, because every living being is part of Krishna. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, one great devotee saint, he wrote that anyone can say they love God. And every religion, there are certain sectors that say that they have the monopoly over God. But the test of one's love for God is we have genuine compassion to all beings. You can't have love without that. Otherwise, it's just a mental conception. It's not a realization. It's not a reality. So when we have this love, it's the thread that harmonizes all the apparent dualities of this world. Happiness, distress, honor, dishonor. If we see that ultimately this little lifetime is just like a single little pencil dot on a long, unlimited line written, drawn by a pencil. Try to imagine like this. There's a pencil line that goes to infinity. Are you with me so far? And it's a really sharp, pointed pencil. And you put one dot on it. That is what our lifetime is. If we see reality from the perspective that this is all, this is one little point, then we think, why is this happening to me? And why is this happening here? And how is this happening? And we become very confused about the situation. Why is it confusing? Because the fact is, it is just one point on an infinite line. But when we see it as the all in all, then we see whatever is happening to us only according to the immediate experience we're having. But we see that success or failure opens special doors to self-improvement on one level and to self-realization on a higher level. I must say this congregation chooses very melodious cell phone ringers. Where was I? Yes?
Happiness and distress open doors for...
Yes, self-realization. If you just always succeeded, life would actually be really boring. Yes? Even though you don't like to fail, it enhances the quality of life when you do. If there was only pleasure, you wouldn't even appreciate the pleasure if there wasn't pain to compare it to. Yes? That's the way the world is. In the spiritual world, you don't need that stuff because there's ananda, that's ecstasy of love. And even there are unlimited variegated situations to increase that love. So when we see from this perspective, health, disease, all the dualities, and even the dualities in our relationships, or let us say, the variations, the diversities. When two people really don't get along because they each have their own issues, and it's real hard to forgive each other for being different or for disappointing me, to keep the relationship together, not just on a ceasefire level, but on a relationship of affection and respect, we simply have to come to a higher platform. We have to focus on something higher. In other words, when these apparent conflicts come, they're teaching us that you can't survive unless you grow. And usually, unless you're in that situation, you're never going to focus on growing. We're just going to be complacent. I've told many times the story of when I was on an airplane and there was an emergency landing and they were putting sirens, not as melodious as these cell phones, like that. They were saying we might crash, you know, we get having an emergency landing, and babies were crying, and the airline hostesses were shaking. And usually when I'm in an airplane, you know, most of us are kind of complacent, yes? You know, you're chanting and you're kind of oh, you're reading and but nobody liked the fact that we could die in a few minutes. But I wasn't complacent. I was really chanting. And I was really praying, and I was really giving my heart to Krishna. And when I think back, I don't want those things to happen again. That's human nature, but it was amazing. So crises between people, crises in our worldly situation, are actually gifts, teaching us, or let us say, inviting us into a higher realm. Srila Prabhupada said, you can show your love for me by how you cooperate. But there's so many reasons not to cooperate. Because you know what the problem is for me? Not every devotee in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness was born in Chicago. Everyone else has weird conceptions, you know? People from California and New York and Canada and Texas and Europe and Africa and South America, and everybody has their different upbringings and they have their different conditions. How are we going to cooperate? And at the same time, in any particular temple situation, there's only so many posts that can be filled, and many times too many people want the same post, and so many people want the same facilities. How do we deal with that? But Prabhupada said you can show your love by how you cooperate. You see the dynamics of all these potential conflicts due to all these differences are an opportunity. And believe it or not, they are a necessity to spiritually grow. Because unless it's right in our face, and as they say in Chicago, we're up against the wall, then we're not going to really take seriously what we have to do to make it work. And the only way we can make it work, and every single person has to take this responsibility, the way we make it work is not by changing everyone else. It has to begin with our changing ourselves. And unless we change ourselves, we can't productively expect to change anyone else. Saint Francis, he instructed his followers, you should always preach. And when necessary, you should say something. That means our character, our example, is actually what's going to make the change. And unless our words are built on the foundation of our character, they may impress people's minds, but they're not going to change people's hearts. What comes from the heart can actually touch another heart. So these diversities actually create an urgency to go deeper, to go higher in our sadhana, in our values, in our character. And ultimately, they help us to really take shelter. Because you see, according to this verse, Daivi Heshu Gunamai, we can't do it ourselves. The dualities and the diversities of this material existence that are apparently so much in conflict are beyond our ability to transcend. But when we're put in those situations, we realize we have to genuinely, honestly, with true humility, take shelter. And when we take shelter with the proper motivations, with the proper guidance, then we can access grace. That grace brings us into a realm of consciousness that is beyond all the diversities in the reality, beyond the dualities. And when we go beyond those dualities, all the diversities can be experienced as gifts of God. All the diversities are actually there to help to bring our love for Krishna within and our love for each other and our love for all beings to a higher conception. Just last week or the week before, we celebrated Ram Navami, the appearance of Ram. What stories did you tell on that event? Did you go through the whole Ramayana? Summarized. Well, I'm going to summarize one little part as an illustration to what we're speaking today. A heartbreaking experience. I remember seeing people hearing this part of Ramayana when I was living in Chitrakoot, and living in Ayodhya, and living in Mithila, and living with Ram sadhus in Patna. I was with a lot of devotees of Ram in my earlier days. And when they would hear this part, people would weep, they would cry from their hearts. Where Bharat and Shatrughna, two of the brothers of Lord Ram, were away at some relative's house. And Ram was going to be coronated as the prince regent. That means officially he will be the next king. But there was a lady named Mantara who was the chief assistant of Kaikeyi, who is the mother of Bharat, the stepmother of Ram. And this Mantara realized that Kaikeyi is the favorite queen of Dasarath, and therefore she's getting so many benefits, and any benefits she gets, she shares with me. And Mantara had a hunched back, and she wasn't beautiful at all, and people naturally didn't like her. She didn't have a good personality or anything, but she was enjoying on a very, very sensual level like anything. She had the finest foods, the finest clothes, the finest jewelry. She had so much power over others. And she was thinking, if Ram becomes the prince regent, then Kaushalya will be the favorite queen because she's Ram's mother. And then if Kaikeyi is neglected, where am I? I become nothing. I become irrelevant. So she had fear. Because she was so insecure, because of her deformities and everything, she was so insecure, she was always suspicious and always afraid. And the power of her envy convinced Kaikeyi to create a whole scheme in which Ram was to be exiled to the forest for 14 years. And Bharat would become the king. And it was actually successful. Now that was the morning. It was quite traumatic. It wasn't like there was time to digest it. That morning he was supposed to be coronated. And that's when he got the news. And he said, no problem, I will go to the forest. Because Ram is the Supreme Lord, but he was playing the role of an ideal human being. Srila Prabhupada gave an example that if a teacher wants us to learn the alphabet, the teacher says, this is the way you do A. You make a line this way, and then you make a line this way, and then you make a line this way. Now everybody go like this. Now she's going through the exercise that the students are supposed to learn with. Now she doesn't need to go through the exercise. She already knows. But she's doing the exercise to show the students how to do it. Yad yad acharati shrestas tad tad evitarojita. What great people do, common people follow. So when the Lord descends, the Lord, especially in this lila or incarnation of Ram, he was demonstrating ideal relationships. His relationship with his father, his relationship with his mother, his relationship with his wife, his relationship with his brothers, his relationship with his guru, his relationship with his friends, his relationship with his followers, his relationship with animals, his relationships with demons. He was just showing the highest integrity. So here he was. Everything was arranged. The whole kingdom was there to celebrate his coronation. And he went and said, I'm going to the forest. I'm happy. He told his mother. She was crying. She said, don't go, don't go. He said, no, I must go. I must protect the honor of my father. And he left. It's a beautiful story. Very dramatic. When Bharat came home and heard what happened, he was horrified. What has been done? I could never sit on the throne of Ram. I love him. We're brothers. It's not a question of who's in what position. It's a question of our love. He didn't want anything except to serve, because there was love. And he went to the forest and brought all the articles to coronate Ram the king in the forest with the vow that when I find him, I will exchange. I will stay in the forest for 14 years and he will come back and be king. That was his determination. In Chitrakoot, a beautiful mountain on the banks of the Mandakini Ganga, he came with so many of the senior people of Ayodhya and presented the idea to Ram. But Lord Ram said, no, I will stay in the forest. You be king. I want you to be king. This is the way we must honor our father. Neither of them wanted the position. There was a long debate. Now this is interesting. They were really arguing. they were arguing like anything, and they each had very, very salient, powerful points. But there was an argument of love. They had very different opinions. But each was the total well-wisher for the other. Bharat was arguing why Ram should go back and he should stay in the forest, and Ram was arguing how, no, I'm staying in the forest and you should be king. It's not like Washington, D.C. these days. Can you imagine the Republicans saying, oh, Democrats, you do, you do. Democrats saying, no, no, you do, you do, you. The politics of love is the different of the politics of material conception. So ultimately, Ram said, this is how you can please me, Bharat. You go back and be king. So Bharat took Ram's sandals. He had a pair of sandals, and he told Ram, please step in these sandals. And Ram stepped in the sandals. Then Bharat put them on his head and said, these sandals will represent you for the next 14 years. And Bharat went back. Now, it was expected he would sit on the throne, he would live in the king's palace, because the father, Dasarath, had already died. There was no king. And he would have all the royalties and all the power and everything else. But what Bharat did is he put the shoes of Ram on the throne, and he didn't even stay in Ayodhya. He would come every day and do his work, but he stayed in Nandigram. That place is still there. Has any of you been to Nandigram near Ayodhya? There, Bharat, he saw how Ram was living in the forest in a straw hut. So he made a straw hut, but not as good as Ram's. And Ram was just eating, because there was no cooks around. He was just eating. In fact, he would not eat cooked food. You know, Sita, Lakshman were with him. They were both excellent cooks, but he took the forest life very seriously. He was wearing tree bark, he matted his hair, and he only ate the roots and the fruits that just grew locally in the forest. So Bharat, for 14 years, he wore only tree bark. He lived in a straw hut, and he only ate fruits and roots. And this is how he ruled the kingdom. And his whole life was just waiting for the day when Ram would sit on the throne again. Such unconditional love that they both had for each other. And even when the climate was so agitated, because you see, there's not only our own egos that creates conflict in our relationships, but there's all kinds of egos around us that could also very much incite division. Have you had that experience? Sometimes brothers grow up so nice, but their wives don't like their husbands. Not their own husband, the other husband. Yes, I've seen it. So many times I see it, and sometimes the other way around. The husbands don't like each other, and the two sisters are, what are we going to do? And it can easily get affected. You know, in a spiritual movement, sometimes people have very, very, you know, sectarian, egoistic views, and they very much influence the way we think. And they kind of feed those insecurities and those egos that are within ourselves and bring out the worst in us. So not only do we have this mind that's affected by the bad dog of selfishness and egoism and lust and envy and anger and greed and illusion. Not only is that within us, but we have so many factors around us that are inciting us in this way, that are creating divisions. Well, Bharat, in his own mother, he loved his mother. But his mother was, no, let Ram die, you are the king, look what I've done for you. Haribol. And everyone was trying to convince Ram to go back. But his love for his brother was so deep that nothing could budge him. Higher principle. And we find that, and Bharat, at every single moment that he was ruling the kingdom from his little straw hut, eating, sometimes he was just drinking cow urine, because he didn't want to enjoy what was meant for Ram. He did it all as an expression of love, to serve. And he maintained Ayodhya in a most wonderful, wonderful way under those conditions for the pleasure of Ram. A little later in the story, Ravana. Ravana was a different kind of person. He was just thinking about me. He didn't know anything about love. He thought he did. He thought he knew everything about everything. But that's the nature of the ego. The more lost you are in the ego, the more you think you know what you're doing. He was a scholar of scripture. He really was. And he convinced an entire kingdom of millions and millions of people. And he convinced himself that he was actually very pious and good. And anything bad he wanted to do, he could justify it. Scripturally, logically, philosophically. Convincingly. So he wanted Sita, Ram's wife, to enjoy for himself. So he disguised himself and had some of his associates with a whole conspiracy, and they distracted Ram and Lakshman and stole Sita away. And in Sri Lanka, Ravana, who was the wealthiest man on earth, his city was built primarily out of gold. Now we see gold plate sometimes on some top of a building or some gold leaf. It's really, really thin. You can't even scrape it off. If you do, you know, you can't do anything with it. But this was buildings made out of solid gold, thick solid gold. Not just like cladding. The bricks, solid gold. That was his wealth, that was his power, that was his opulence. He had it all, but he wasn't happy. He needed Sita. He had so many ladies to enjoy, the most heavenly damsels. But he wanted Sita. The Srimad Bhagavatam tells about Hiranyakashipu. He conquered the universe, but it explained he could never find a moment of real happiness because he hadn't conquered his own mind and senses. The more you have, the more you need. If you're not finding happiness within yourself, you cannot find it anywhere, no matter what you have, no matter what you achieve, no matter what you can do. Love is about experiencing the wealth within ourselves and using our abilities, our capacities to express that love. But when we don't find that within, then we're trying to replace that vacuum, fill that vacuum with stuff from the outside. Power, money, property, fame, incredible skills. What we don't understand is all that stuff can't go beyond that sharp-pointed dot on the infinite line. It doesn't go beyond that. It hardly can be sustainable even within the context of that dot. I think we have that experience. He had what everybody wants, but he wasn't happy. And Sita, she could have been the princess above all others, but all she wanted was Ram. This is the dynamics of the Ramayana. And Hanuman, he was a brahmachari. All he wanted is to serve, unconditional love. His life, his soul. The dynamics of Hanuman's consciousness, historically, symbolically, whatever way you want to understand it, let's try to analyze it very briefly. Hanuman was willing to give his life, his every drop of his heart and energy, just to bring Sita back to Ram. And as a brahmachari, he had no possessions. He didn't want anything else. It's not like he was some sort of, what do they call those, mercenaries or something, where you fight and you get money for it, or you share some of the loot. Well, if you conquer Sri Lanka, there's a golden city. You can get a, you know, just one brick is worth more than practically anybody has today. But Hanuman wanted, his only aspiration was just to see Ram and Sita happy together. That's seva, unconditional love. And that love wasn't just, you know, sitting peacefully in a shanti state. Praying is beyond shanti. He jumped across an ocean. And then when he went across the ocean, he had to disguise himself. So were millions of powerful warriors with mystical yogic powers and very developed weapons. And he was alone. And he wasn't supposed to be there. So he kind of disguised himself and made himself little so he could just jump around. And he was looking everywhere for Sita. And he was seeing unbelievable. He was seeing furniture made out of emeralds and rubies and diamonds and the most incredible stones. Hand-carved intricately, delicately designed gold and silver everywhere. He wasn't attracted to any of it. He was just looking for Sita. He could have stole so much stuff if he wanted, because everyone was sleeping. You know, a long ways. He would have done his job and found Sita, but still, he could have just stole all kinds of stuff. But he didn't want anything else. And when he found Sita, he pacified her heart. He gave her Ram's ring. And she gave him a stone to bring back to Ram. He fulfilled his duty, but he wanted to do something more. And he knew by doing this, he was really going to get in trouble. He started tearing Ravana's favorite garden apart. He's all alone. He's in Sri Lanka. He started ripping down the trees. And Ravana was very proud. You know, he would bring other kings from other places, and to impress them, he would show them his Ashok garden. Oh, how beautiful. It took a long time to grow it, too. So Ravana heard about it, and he started sending generals and soldiers, and Hanuman was fighting with all of them. And his whole purpose was to get kidnapped, was to get captured, made a prisoner, and be face to face with Ravana. And that's what happened. He was tied up. He stood face to face against Ravana, and around Ravana was his most powerful soldiers with weapons, and Hanuman's all alone standing like that. And Ravana was insulting him, but you see, for a devotee who has discovered that transcendental love within herself or himself, honor and dishonor, it really doesn't make that much difference. It only really affects us when our level of satisfaction or fulfillment is on such a superficial, shallow level. Just like in a river. If you're on the surface of the river, all the waves and the winds and the rains really affect you. But if you're deep in the current of the river, you don't even notice the rains and the winds. So we're only affected by the different transformations of this world because we're so shallow in our realization of life, in our realization of who we are, of who is God, and what is real happiness. And you see, it doesn't matter how much knowledge you have within our brains. It doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't matter how much skills you have. It doesn't matter how much power you have. It doesn't matter how much followers you have. None of that brings us any deeper. You can have it or not have it. But Hanuman was satisfied within. He fearlessly stood before Ravana and told Ravana, "You are a coward." And that's the worst thing you could say. You know, in every culture, in every place of the world, there's the things you say that really insult someone. I'm not going to go into details about this. But I remember when I was traveling with Gary, we were in Italy, and somebody said, "Don't do a certain signal, because people will really not like it." But, you know, a signal like that in America, nobody could care less. So, you know, there was a bus. We were hitchhiking on the side of the road. This is 1970. We're hitchhiking on the side of the road, and a bus of soldiers was driving by. And we wanted them to pick us up, so we went like this. But they just drove by really fast. So Gary kind of thought, and he did that signal, "I'm not going to do it," because I forgot what it is. But when he did it, you know, he was thinking, he was just, But they weren't going, The bus slammed on its brake, and every soldier came filing out of the bus and started running to beat us. And we ran away like anything. And they were running a long way, and they were running and running, and we were running, and finally we ran off the road and started running over mountains, and we got away. We were pretty fast runners, actually. But, you know, they were about a half a block away, so we had a lead. I said, "Gary, why did you do that?" And Gary said, well, it doesn't mean anything. Why did they take it so seriously? I said, it doesn't mean anything to us, but it does for them. So, you know, there's different things. And, you know, this is, I've seen it in marriages or in relationships like that, where you know each other enough, you know what to say to really disturb the person you want to disturb. Yes? You just know which button to press. And if somebody else hears it, they think, so what? But the person you... And it's... Well, Hanuman knew a kshatriya. Dishonor is worse than death. There's nothing in the 14 worlds you can say to insult somebody like Ravana more than, you are a coward. And he said it right to his face. And if they were all alone, Ravana could say, just don't tell anyone else. But, but he said it in a public assembly, where all Ravana's children and his grandchildren and his wives and his generals and his soldiers and his ministers, they were all there seeing him say, you are a coward. Then he was given evidence. Why didn't you face Ram directly to take Sita? Why you diverted him away and stole Sita away when he was not there? Like a jackal steals the food that's meant for a lion. Ravana, his mind went out of control. Hanuman was successful. He's very psychologically astute. He went out of control and he said, kill this monkey! And Vibhishan, Ravana's brother, who was a great devotee, he said, no, you can't. You will lose your prestige if you kill him. Because it is the honor among kshatriyas, or valiant warriors, that you cannot kill a messenger. You could punish him, but you cannot kill him. And he's a messenger of your enemy. He's come with a message for you. So Ravana wanted to do worse than killing him. He wanted to torture him until he died. He said, monkeys are proud of their tails. Set his tail on blazing fire. And Hanuman was so happy. Because he wasn't seeing it, oh, I'm going to get tortured and I'm going to die. He was thinking, how can I serve Ram in this situation? Love. This is how love transcends the dualities of nature. Pleasure, pain, honor, dishonor. So he was tied up, very tight, with mystic snake ropes. Not like just like cotton ropes or... And they wrapped his tail with layers and layers and layers of this gauze, very flammable. Then they dipped it all in this flammable oil and they lit it. And immediately... wasn't like, you know, a stick of incense. It just, in a big tail, and they really put a massive amount of this flammable gauze and they soaked it totally in flammable oil, and as soon as they lit it, this massive fire pouring off of his tail. And that's his body. The children seem to be waking up. In India, every boy wants to be Hanuman when they're real little, and they start beating everyone with their clubs. That's my experience anyway. Swamis have our observations of family life. But Hanuman, he sees his tail blazing and it's going up like incense. It's going, you know, it's not going to stay there. It's going to go up to his body and it's just rapidly going. And he says, how may I serve? And by his, he just, what is the opportunity? And he somehow, he expanded his body with his strength. Then he made it smaller and he slipped out of the ropes. And then he jumped. And he jumped right out of that assembly hall where everybody was and went to the top of a palace. And on the top of the palace, he had this blazing tail that Ravana himself ordained to light. And he touched the tail to the palace. Immediately, the whole palace went on fire. And Hanuman jumped to the next palace and then took his tail and went, it's hard to throw, I don't have the tail. He made his tail touch the palace and then, and he was jumping from house to house, palace to palace, assembly hall to assembly hall, government assemblies, everything, wherever he was going. He was just lighting it all. There's a message here. You see, Ravana started the fire, but because he started the fire with enmity toward another, that fire came back to burn his own wealth. And similarly, when we try to hurt others, when we have enmity, envy, viciousness, hate toward another, ultimately, like the tale of Hanuman, the fire of that negative quality is going to burn us from within. And karmically, it's going to burn us from without in due course of time. Very good message. He started the fire himself that destroyed his kingdom. That's the nature of enmity. And after Hanuman burnt most of the city down, with a very loud voice, he said to Ravana, he said, I am just the least among the servants of Ram. Wait till the other servants come. And we get all our power from Ram. Wait till Ram comes. But you still have another chance. Just give up Sita. And Ram will protect you. Keep her, and he will destroy you. And then he jumped in the ocean, put his tail out, and then jumped back. And then he went to meet Ram in Kishkindha Kshetra. Ram was living in a cave. That cave is still there today. You could go if you like. It's called Prashravana, or also Malyavanta. And Ram came out of his cave to meet Hanuman. And Hanuman told the whole story of meeting Sita and Sita's message to him, and how he related Ram's message to Sita. And then he talked about all the extra services he did. You see, nobody detected that he came in. He could have come out the same way. He wanted to do something extra. And he did. And he wanted nothing for himself. Just like Bharat wanted nothing for himself. The greatest treasure is the treasure of love. And that love is expressed through service. And Ram told Hanuman, He said, I'm living in the forest in exile, so I have no possessions whatsoever. I have nothing to give you as a reward. He said, all I have is my embrace. And with deep satisfaction and infinite transcendental love, Ram embraced Hanuman. And that was the one and only thing that Hanuman could ever want. There's a saying. Are you ready for a saying? Is everyone awake? And alert? Okay. Try to keep your cell phones off for a few moments. The saying, if you want to know how rich you are, find out how many things you have that money cannot buy. That is real wealth. The things that money cannot buy is not wealth. Real wealth is the inner treasure. The things that money cannot buy. Money cannot buy love. Money cannot buy grace. When we have those things, we have true wealth. And we can be billionaires, millionaires, or monks living in a cave. Doesn't matter. That wealth is within the hearts of all of us. And when it's there, we can, whatever position we're in, we use it. Eventually, there was a great battle. And as Hanuman predicted, Ravana and his entire dynasty was destroyed. And his brother, Vibhishan, he was made the king by Ram. Ram didn't want it for himself. Hanuman didn't want it. Even Vibhishan didn't want it. But Ram told Vibhishan, no, I want you to do this as a service to me. You live as the royal king of Sri Lanka. So he did. But then the exile was over, and it was time to return. And I will end with this little story. Ram told Hanuman that Bharat has been ruling the kingdom for 14 years. And now it's time for me to come back and reclaim the kingdom. But I don't want to do that if Bharat likes being king. This was the love between them. If from the core of his heart, he really, really, really wants me to come and be the king, then I'll go back to do it just to please him. But you see, even amongst the great saints and yogis and devotees, still the nature of this world, when you have so much, you can become attached to it. Even in the line of service, there's a tendency to be attached. Sometimes we become attached to being a guru, or attached to being a president, or attached to be a GBC, or attached to be a head cook, or attached to be a Sankirtan leader, or attached to be a mother or a father, whatever it may be. We have these attachments. They're natural. even among very elevated. So Ram said, Bharat has been ruling for 14 years. If he has even the slightest speck of a trace of attachment to doing it, then he must continue. Unless his love for me to come back and do it is totally unconditional and pure, I will not come back. Now a question. How do you determine if a person has the slightest inkling of a trace of a desire within their heart? How do we understand that? Ram knew that it takes one to know one, because Hanuman had a completely pure, unconditional heart, full of love and the desire to serve. He could detect if there was a trace in Bharat. So Ram told Hanuman, I'm going on the Pushpaka, Ravana's chariot. It's really an incredible chariot. It's like a little city that could fly. He said, I'm coming with, you know, Sita and Lakshman and so many others on the chariot, and we're going to be going toward Ayodhya, but you go before us, and you go to Nandigram, to that little straw hut where Bharat is living. And you tell him that the exile is over and Ram is returning. And if you detect, either through his facial expressions, his bodily movements, the tone of his voice, or your own intuition, that he has even of a trace of remorse that he's going to lose the power he has, then you tell me, and I will give him all honor and respect and serve him as the king. So Hanuman came. He jumped forward, and there was Bharat. And Bharat was, as soon as Hanuman met Bharat, Bharat said, the exile time is over. When is Ram coming? When is Ram coming? And Hanuman said, Ram is on his way. And Hanumanji, he wasn't sentimental, because this was Ram's service. He had to be totally comprehensive in his analysis. It's very scientific. He examined from his core of his heart, he examined the reaction of Bharat. And Bharat, tears poured from his eyes and his arms went up. Ram is coming. When is he coming? Where is he coming from? And Hanuman said, he's coming from that direction. And Bharat was just looking. And Hanuman realized his wealth, his unlimited, inconceivable wealth of love. He wanted nothing but to serve and give pleasure to his beloved. And Hanuman was so pleased to see the purity of Bharat's love. Hanuman felt completely humbled and insignificant in the presence of Bharat. And he embraced Bharat, and Bharat embraced Hanuman, and they were crying and weeping and ecstasy and dancing. They were doing kirtan. This is praying kirtan. Kirtan of love. And then Bharat would say, when is he coming? When is he coming? He was just looking at the horizon. Bharat was saying, he is coming, he is coming, Bharat, but I don't see him, the horizon, it's time. Where is he? Where is he? Are you sure? Yes, he's coming. Where? And it was going on for some hours. And finally, Hanuman, his heart just exploded with bliss. And he pointed his finger and said, Bharat, look, he's come. And they saw in the distant horizon this small little Pushpaka coming. And they both began to dance and celebrate. And when he arrived, he came off his chariot, he came off the chariot Ram, and the first thing he did is he went to Bharat and embraced him. This is Ramayana. It's the story of unconditional love. It's the story of real wealth. It's unity and diversity. Hanuman wasn't a king, he was a monkey. But they were unified. Unified by the higher principle. And in all of our relationships, and in all of our interactions of life, the model we find here in its purest state, we cannot imitate, but we should apply this model. We should apply these principles in every single aspect of our life, in our encounters with nature, in our encounters with circumstances, in our relationships with people. This is bhakti. To make that internal change within ourself. And Ram, Krishna, appeared in this age of Kali as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya saw this beautiful Sadbuja, a six-armed form of the Lord. Two arms were blue arms of Krishna playing the flute. Two were Ram. His arms were the color of the durba grass with a bow and an arrow. And two were Lord Chaitanya, his beautiful golden arms holding a danda and a kamandalu water pot. Ram appeared and he showed us the highest principles of love through his devotees. Hanuman, Bharat, Jatayu, Guha, Kausalya. Krishna came and manifested the highest reciprocations of love with his devotees, the gopas, the gopis, Sri Radha. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to give that, to give entrance into that same realm of love to everyone and anyone. Whether we're rich or poor, or whether we're from any part of the world, or from any caste, or any religion, or any sex, or whether we're even animals. He gave that love to tigers and snakes and insects, if they just open their heart to receive it. And he gave it through Param Vijayate Sri Krishna Sankirtana, the benediction, the prime benediction of the chanting of the Lord's holy names. When we value this spirit of servitude and try to live following in the footsteps of these great personalities, and in that spirit, when we chant the holy names sincerely, attentively, with humility, an inner transformation takes place. We discover the infinite wealth that we all have. Do you know what that wealth is? We gradually understand how Krishna loves us. Krishna's love is infinite. Last night, I gave a lecture near the University of Chicago, and there was a quantum mechanics physicist, scientist, who was explaining, you know, before the lecture, some of the concepts of scientific discoveries. And I don't have the time or the abilities to actually explain them to you. But if you like, you could attend University of Chicago. Scientific department. But really what he was saying is how totally inconceivable matter is. Creation. The energies of matter have such inconceivable potencies. It's beyond the capacity of human intelligence, how it works. And that's just how cells and atoms are working. Krishna made it that way. And if we see it from a bigger perspective, how the atomic particles are working are totally inconceivable. And how they're interacting with each other. It's amazing. We can't even see it. We can't even with our best possible microscopes of the 21st century, we can't really see those energies that are activating these neutrons and protons and electrons. It's incredible. We can only understand by symptoms of what's happening, of what's behind it. And a larger scale, the sun. It's just floating in the sky. It's quite inconceivable. And it gives off so much light and so much heat. It's tens and thousands of times bigger than planet Earth. It's a ball of fire. Now for us to keep a fire going, it's really hard. You know, there's wars and all kinds of espionage and stuff over trying to get fuel, right? Oil. Previously there were wars over coal. Now there's so much disputes and greed over oil because we need power, fire. Because if you want, you know, how many of you have ever run out of gas in your automobile? Anyways, you know, it doesn't matter if you have a PhD. It doesn't matter if you are an auto mechanic who knows exactly how every single part of that car is operating. If you don't have gasoline, it doesn't move. Yes? In Chicago, in the winter, without heat, what do you do? You freeze. So whether it's our heater, whether it's our car, whether it's our incense, yeah, you have to have something to keep that energy alive. But look at the sun. It's not like the demigods have solar pipes that go through the air to get, you know, some oil or some natural gases to keep the sun going. It just keeps going for millions of years, and it doesn't even get smaller. Isn't that incredible? Where's the energy coming from? Why doesn't it burn out? And why it stays exactly where it's supposed to be? If it got a little too close, we all die. If it gets a little too far, we all die. Creation from the largest, and that's just within this tiny little speck of our universe. Achintya Shakti, inconceivable potency. You know, in the Vedas, creation is Krishna just desires creation. And he just exhales and the whole cosmic manifestation comes as a fulfillment of his desire. That's power. What we find in the scriptures and in the realizations of the saints, that power is insignificant compared to his spiritual power. The greatest of all the opulences of Krishna is his opulence of love. He's all attractive. The beauty and the sweetness of his love. He has infinite, inconceivable, unsurpassable, incomprehensible love for every living entity. For the soul in the mosquito. Remember that when he's biting you. He has infinite love for that little soul. He has infinite love for the soul of each and every one of us. This humbles us. When we understand, when we are touched with the realization of how much Krishna loves us, it doesn't really matter what happens in this crazy world. Even if there's world wars, of course, we want to try to create peace, we want to try to create harmony, that's our service. But whatever happens beyond our control, Krishna's love for us is beyond any of the things that happen in this little sharp point pencil dot of this little world we live in and this little lifetime we're in. And when we experience Krishna's love, infinite love for us, unlimited love for us, when we understand it, when we realize it, when we taste it, then naturally we reciprocate with unconditional infinite love for Krishna. And once that's there, then there's love and compassion in all circumstances. That's the essence of religion. That's the purpose of life. And when we experience that, we don't become proud. You see, on the material platform, we compete. I have something. I don't want anybody else to have as much as me. Yes? Like, I don't give very good classes, but, you know, I give a class. But an ego, you know, ego would mean, I really don't want anybody to give a class as good as me. They can give good ones, but not as good. And definitely not better. Right? That's the nature of ego. I want to cook something wonderful, and I want everyone to like it, but nobody else should cook as good as me. I could dance. But it will really disturb me if somebody can dance as good as me. That's the ego. Because we're empty inside. We need these things. Useless things. Fame, adoration, all this stuff. But where there's love, when we taste Krishna's infinite love for us, we're totally satisfied. But it humbles us because we know that Krishna has that same love for everyone. And everyone has that same potential to love Krishna. That understanding is the supreme unifying ingredient within a world of unlimited variations, and in a world of so many dualities. And this is the matchless gift that Srila Prabhupada was presenting to all of us and to the whole world. through properly understanding the culture of bhakti and the chanting of the holy names. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. Very nice.
Ram Bhakti Hanuman Ji Ki.
So how may I serve you? Oh. Shall I lead kirtan for you?